Hello, everyone, and welcome to this audio conference training for rural grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. My name is Liz Carlson, and I'll be the host for this training. Today's topic is what DV advocates need to know about child sexual abuse, and I'm joined on the line today by our guest, Karen Omi. I'm delighted to be on the line with Karen, and I'd like to just welcome you today, Karen.
Thank you, Liz.
Yeah, glad you could be here. Karen's going to get started on that topic in just a minute. Before she begins, I would like to just go over a couple of miscellaneous housekeeping details for you. I'd like to just let you all know that the operator will keep all of the phone lines muted for the duration of this call today. And at various points, Karen will be taking your questions and comments. And at that point, the operator will tell each of you how you can get into the question and comment queue. And at that time, your phone lines will be unmuted individually. So you don't have to worry about background noise where you're calling from. That's always a nice thing. Finally, we record these sessions and we make them available online for listening to or downloading from our website. So if you go to the Rural TA section of our website, you will see past archived recordings. And in short order, this one will be posted there if you would like to go back perhaps with your coworkers or something after the fact. So I believe each of you should have received a little bio for Karen as well as her outline for discussion today. So I'm not going to take any time away from the training and further introduce her, but ask Karen, rather, if she would introduce herself and the topic and get us rolling at this point. So Karen, it's all yours.
Thank you so much, Liz. I really appreciate it. And welcome to all of you who are on the line today. I want to applaud you for coming on the line today because we actually have a smaller group than the wider group of grantees. And I applaud you because it is crucial and yet not universally recognized that people who work with survivors of domestic violence truly need to understand the dynamics of and the realities of child sexual abuse, because there is a wide occurrence, co-occurrence, of sexual abuse within domestic violence. And we're going to talk about that today, but I am also applauding you because one of the facts of life about child sexual abuse is that it is extremely difficult to have to learn about, to be subject to information about. And one of the reasons for that is because no matter how many people are listening to me train today, if you think of yourselves, instead of being isolated in your offices, but you think of yourselves as a group, sort of a virtual group, there are a number of us on the line today who ourselves are victims, were victims of child sexual abuse, that have child sexual abuse victimization histories, okay? And I have done this training and trainings like this for years now, for years. And I have moderated groups as large as 200 people and as small as 25 people. And the similarities between those two sizes of groups are these. Every single time I've done this training, I have women coming up to me afterwards, sometimes standing up and having to leave the room during my presentation, and telling me that they themselves have sexual abuse histories that they have not themselves dealt with yet. So the first thing that I really want to talk about, for applauding you for learning about this, but also applauding your bravery to those of you who have or are going to be confronting your own victimization histories. I applaud you for doing that, and I want you to know that the first, most important part of starting this session is to emphasize self-care. So if you yourself have not dealt with issues that you've got about your own histories, you will be much better supports to survivors of domestic violence and non-offending parents whose children have been sexually victimized if you yourselves deal with your own issues, okay? And it's not only true for you, but if you represent organizations and you want to bring back this information to your agency or to your coworkers or your colleagues, no conversation about child sexual abuse can be had without first talking about the self-care of those who are trying to help these families. Okay? And so I want to say that. And if you yourself have not, do not have a history of victimization, please do not minimize this in your own mind. It is a huge issue. It sometimes will take quite a long time for a person, an adult, who has yet to confront her own issues, her own history, to deal with these things. But you will be better service to survivors when you yourselves have dealt with these issues and your colleagues have dealt with these issues. So that being said, what are we actually talking about for the co-occurrence of domestic violence and child sexual abuse? Well, when we talk about child sexual abuse and domestic violence, we talk in the same language, right? It's the same language that you're going to be hearing. You're going to be hearing very familiar statements about child sexual abuse because it's so similar to and has so many similarities with, but is still, of course, different from domestic violence. The incidence is very difficult to proclaim with any certainty, just like in domestic violence, because as you all know, the incidence of domestic violence is underreported. Everyone agrees that the incidence of domestic violence is underreported. And that is the same as with child sexual abuse. The researchers who have done work in this field opine that between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 women have been sexually abused as children, and between 5 to 10% of men. So the research does hold out consistently that girls are more often victims of child sexual abuse, but that boys also have been. Okay, so the first thing we note, the first similarity, of course, is the chronic underreporting. And underreporting, of course, means that victims are out there who have not been helped. Okay. The second commonality in the discussion of domestic violence and child sexual abuse is the issue of stigma. Just as domestic violence occurs behind closed doors, so does child sexual victimization. This, like domestic violence, is a crime that is committed in private, behind closed doors. No one wants to talk about it. It's the family's dirty little secret. And so, again, we are talking in the same language as domestic violence. The power and control issue, of course, you're very familiar with domestic violence, and there have been researchers like Lundy Bancroft who have said that they can understand how a child would not report sexual abuse, and we'll talk about that dynamic in a minute, but they can understand how a child wouldn't report when the child has already witnessed the violence that a perpetrator has used against the child's other parent. Okay, in other words, domestic violence is an issue of power. Child abuse is an issue of power, that the victim is powerless against the abuser. So this issue of power and control, this issue of no boundaries, where the perpetrator simply treats the child as an object. There's a certain objectification for the perpetrator's own gratification in child sexual abuse that we see many commonalities with in the issue of domestic violence. And this issue of secrecy, of course, shrouds the entire area, the entire subject, all the dynamics. And so we look at those things, and it brings us to the realization of how children could possibly accommodate to, and when I use the word accommodate, what I mean is live with, get used to, but only in a way that, you know, marginally, being sexually abused. And one of the most difficult things, and you'll hear again familiar language, one of the most difficult things for adults who have not been victimized is understanding how a child could be raped, how a child could be sexually abused and not report it. Of course, light bulbs are going off in all your heads because you've seen time and time again where people blame the victim and cannot imagine why a victim kept domestic violence secret for years, sometimes for nearly a lifetime. But the Child Sexual Abuse Accommodation Syndrome was developed actually back in the 80s, and there are other theories about why children could or and how children could accommodate to child sexual abuse besides this Child Sexual Abuse Accommodation Syndrome. But this is the one that we think people seem to be able to grasp. And when you're only doing, you know, an hour and a half, a 90-minute training, this is probably the easiest way to kind of wrap your mind around these dynamics. And, of course, since you are survivor advocates and victim advocates, you can understand how this happens. And so what we'll talk about is the dynamic starting accommodation is this issue of secrecy. Okay, so we've got this offender's behavior. So the offender, he's either overtly or he's covertly telling the victim that this sexual behavior is a secret. Now, he may say things like, if you tell, they'll put me in jail. If you tell, I will kill your mother. Or all kinds of threats. And these are the similar threats that you've heard in domestic violence, right? So there's this threatening that's done by the perpetrator. And the child's reaction can be fear, confusion. She may feel guilty about having enjoyed the special attention that she's received from the grooming process. And you've probably all heard the concept of grooming. What grooming is really increased physical contact that is meant to encourage the victim to accept more and more and more physical contact and more sexualized physical contact until there's actually penetration and until there's actually abuse. But the trap in grooming is that the child craves attention from an abuser. It wants to be hugged and patted and stroked, wants to lapse it and be hugged, you know, and wants that physical attention, but does not want the sexualized behavior. And, of course, the perpetrator takes advantage of the child's need, and we all know from our, you know, your classes in psychology, you know, in Psychology 101, that human beings need physical affection. We desire physical affection, and the perpetrator takes advantage of this. And so everything is now wrapped in secrecy. And the offender is using also isolation. There's, again, commonality in the discussions, and intimidation, and taking advantage of this, the child's helplessness in face of this authoritative adult. Again, more power, more control. Now, remember, sexual abuse does not happen in every domestic violence case, and we don't know exactly what the co-occurrence is. I've heard researchers say they guess maybe 35%, but there's no way to know. But we do know at here at the Institute for Family Violence Studies, in dealing with victims and dealing with families in crisis, that time and time and time again, we've been dealing with thinking we've been dealing with a domestic violence case, and only after a long period of time, sometimes, has the victim divulged that there's also been child sexual abuse. And we have had researchers who've made lots of comparison and drawn lots of lines between the two. But you do not, so there's not a straight line forward from domestic violence into child sexual abuse. But there very often is a straight line backwards. From when we find out that a child's being sexually abused, we do find out that there's also been domestic violence. So you need to know that we don't know exactly the co-occurrence, but researchers do believe there is a wide co-occurrence. So we have this secrecy and this power and control. And the next element of a child abuse, sexual abuse accommodation syndrome, is this feeling of helplessness. Of course, you've seen this also in domestic violence. But the offender is now taking advantage of the natural power and authority that he holds and that adults hold over children. And at this point, this is when the perpetrator is saying to the victim, nobody is going to believe you, right? Or nobody really cares about you. And I'm going to deny it, and the non-offending parent will side with me. This is the threat that makes the child feel even more helpless. And the child feels powerless to stop the abuse. And this is a dynamic of the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome that adults who've never been traumatized, who've never been victimized, have a very hard time understanding. Why doesn't the child start screaming bloody murder, this is what happened to me? So the third category of the syndrome is entrapment and accommodation. So here we have the offender lying, distorting his actions, minimizing them, right? Again, we have the common language. And this is where you get, and you've probably seen this before in highly publicized cases, the offender telling the victim, this is what all daddies do, or he's only teaching her how to be a good wife, or he's minimizing his behavior. And the child is now just trying to survive. This is a survival skill. Just like victims of domestic violence, they are just trying to survive. And the child's response to repeated sexual victimization can be by denying the feelings, blaming herself, withdrawing, denying from what's happening or minimizing, and also dissociating from abuse. I mean, we had a case, because I've worked with the clearinghouse on supervised visitation for over a decade, and we had a case once where the child was two and still in diapers, and every time the father put the child on the changing table to change the child's diapers, she fell asleep. And it was after repeated times that people started thinking, this might not be right. There might be something else going on here. And then lo and behold, when they started going back into the child protective notes, that there actually were allegations of sexual abuse, and when the child was examined, there were signs that the child had been sexually abused. But my point is about dissociating from abuse. And this can also explain why some sexually abused children, and actually a lot of sexually abused children, can interact with an abusive parent in a seemingly appropriate manner, right? There are no telltale signs. The child is not acting afraid of that offending parent, okay? Because the child has learned to dissociate when there are other people around. This child knows that this parent is not going to offend right now, and so she doesn't act with fear. It's also, of course, a way of explaining why kids still love an offending parent. They love the parent, they just don't love the abuse. They want the abuse to stop, but they want to continue to see the parent. Okay, you've of course heard all this in domestic violence, right? She wants the abuse to stop, but she still loves the abuser. So what happens next is in the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome. So we've had secrecy, helplessness, entrapment and accommodation, and now disclosure, all right? And this is what's really tricky about child sexual abuse. And I want you to remember this. Disclosure is not an event. Generally, disclosure is not an event. It's a process where the child tests the waters to see whether she or he can, but for purposes of this, I will refer to the victim as she. She tries to tell. She may tell a relative. She may tell a teacher. She may tell the non-offending parent. And then seeing the reaction of that person to the information that's coming out of the child's mouth, the horror, the shock, the fear, the child takes it back. And the last stage of the accommodation syndrome is recanting. So when you have disclosure, you've got now an offender who's denying the abuse. Okay, a disclosure is made. The offender is denying. If the child even gets that far, first the child's testing the waters. If the person that they're telling seems receptive to hearing, the child tells the full story. The offender goes berserk, denies, calls the victim a liar, calls the victim mentally ill, right? You've heard it against victims of domestic violence. And, of course, the offender then can further threaten the victim to try to get the victim to remain silent or to, at this point, to recant. So recanting should be seen by experts as a normal part of the dynamic. In other words, it seems now that you know about the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome, doesn't it seem absolutely normal and expected that a child at some point would recant? Because when a child discloses, that child's world ends. The child is often plucked from the home, or the perpetrator is plucked from the home. And at that point, all kinds of terrible things happen. Sometimes the child and the non-offending parent, the mom, they move to a shelter. The child goes to a different school, has a different set of friends, is kept in a room with bunk beds where, you know, she was in her own home before with her family pet, the child separated from pets and friends and routines, and has taken this incredible risk and is now suffering from taking that risk. And so we should look at recanting as expected. And yet what happens in the system, what happens in the child custody, the child litigation system, and the court system, is that people say, aha, the child made it all up. I knew it. If we look at the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome as something that happens in most cases, you know, not in all cases, because you will have those cases of a child who is raped one time and tells, and then the system never recants, right? There's no secrecy. The child does feel emboldened. You know, those are going to be the exception rather than the rule, according to Summit. Roland Summit is the person who actually wrote the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome. All right, now, what I also want you to understand is when, and as you know, so the child's taking this huge risk. Victims of domestic violence take this enormous risk when they go and they get their injunction for protection or their orders for protection in court. So a victim of domestic violence goes and takes this huge risk, and she gets this injunction, and she kicks him out of the house. And her world is now topsy-turvy, right? Family is taking sides. People at work are taking sides. There's all kinds of chaos going on in the home. At that point, and maybe she's getting supervised visitation for the kids, I mean, and now the case is under incredible scrutiny, and now anything that she's ever done in her past, he's dredging up to use against her. So you think about that moment. You think about that moment when a victim of domestic violence has taken the ultimate step, the biggest risk of her life, which is not, in her mind, probably staying with him, but is actually going out and telling the truth and trying to get away from him. At that point, she's probably figuring it's in her best interest to keep her mouth shut about the child, any child sexual abuse that's happened. Because I will tell you that if child sexual abuse has happened in that relationship also, she's probably thinking, I got away with my life, getting this injunction, getting out of the house. If I tell what happened to my child, I know he's going to come get me and kill me. So I want you to be aware, this is why survivors of domestic violence don't always divulge. This is why people are professionals still fool themselves. I hate to use the term fool themselves. Can still believe that they take domestic violence cases, they don't take sexual abuse cases. That's why people still see that there's this huge dichotomy between the two scenarios, the two dynamics. But I hope, and it's always difficult in one of these conversations on the phone where I'm just basically talking to my plants in my office, hoping they understand. I'm hoping that you see the similarities and so you understand how these two dynamics are so similar and how they could coexist, and how you might not realize that the sexual abuse could be a part of this. Okay, at this point, I've got on the agenda that we have some time for questions before we proceed. Liz and operator?
Okay, at this time, if you'd like to ask a question, all you need to do is press the number 1 once on your touch tone phone. All answers, all questions will be answered in the order that they are received. Keep in mind that pressing the number one more than once will actually remove you from the queue, so be careful to press the number one only once unless your question has been answered by a previous caller. And it looks like at this time we do not have any questions.
So do you want me to proceed? Wait a minute for people to think? Or
yeah, let's just wait a moment if we can. And I wonder, Karen, if you can just talk a little bit more about, you talked about recanting and how that impacts child custody evaluations. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, are there things...
Yes.
Is that going to be later in the discussion today, or
Well, okay. I can jump to some of the important things now, and then we'll hit it again in a little while. But here's what... Okay, so if you understand the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome and you get to the issue of recanting, and now you're in, you see your client in a child custody case, all right? There's some things that you really need to understand. And the first one is, and I've been burned on this before, so just take it from me and don't make the mistakes that I've made. Lots of courts will bring in mental health professionals. You've got your... all of the players who are sometimes brought into these cases, depending on your state and also your local jurisdiction's practices. But oftentimes you see all these people from your parenting evaluators, parenting coordinators, counselors. You've got your guardians ad litem. You've got your, what do we have? Your child advocacy centers. You've got, victim advocates. You have all these people who are now involved in this custody case. And when you have a parenting evaluator or you have people who are billed as mental health professionals, so anybody who goes under that column in your case, and they can be by any name that you call them in your jurisdiction, it is not good enough for them to just have a licensed mental health to be a licensed mental health counselor or to be a marriage and family therapist or to have initials after their name. You need to really make sure that this professional has expertise, has specific training in child sexual abuse cases. And I say that, and people are probably thinking, well, you know, doesn't everybody? And see, here's the answer. No. No. And it's not a substitute. You know, having expertise in marriage and family therapy is not a substitute for having expertise in child sexual abuse. And the same is true for guardians ad litem. And let me tell you, the states are very late to this game, but Florida's been trying to make up for lost time with some of the mistakes. I know that the domestic violence community, people in the domestic violence community may have mixed feelings about guardians ad litem, but we in Florida have been really focused on trying to make sure that guardians ad litem have training in domestic violence and child sexual abuse. See, it's not enough to just understand the dynamics of domestic violence when you're a GAL or when you're a mental health professional. You also have to understand child sexual abuse issues. And this became a real big issue in Florida 2 years ago. In 2007, the Florida legislature actually changed the statute because we had these kids who were being supervised. You know, the court had ordered supervised visitation, whether it was by child protective workers or in supervised visitation programs, and these were child sexual abuse cases. Now, either they were identified as child sexual abuse initially, or we found out there were issues of child sexual abuse after the case had already been taken under supervision, and the people who were supervising had no expertise in child sexual abuse issues. And so the Florida legislature passed what's called the Keeping Children Safe Act in 2007 that requires that anybody who supervises visits pursuant to a court order in a child sexual abuse case, and there's a whole long laundry list of things that you'd have, all the different statutes, lewd and lascivious behavior, all the way down to, you know, rape and prostitution and pornography and possession of child pornography, all the whole laundry list. That people who supervised visits in those cases had to have specific training in child sexual abuse dynamics. Because if you don't, you your supervision may be meaningless. Lundy Bancroft, you probably all know him as the author of The Batterer's Parent, really hits the nail on the head when he says that supervision is meaningless if it's not vigilant. But my argument to you is that vigilance is only meaningful when it's informed. It has to be informed vigilance. You have to know what you're looking for. And believe me, there's a lot that you have to look for in child sexual abuse cases. Just like in domestic violence cases, there are ways to convey, you know, the whole argument about mediation in domestic violence cases, right? He's looking at her a certain way, and she knows that if she answers the question wrong, she's going to get it later. I mean, he's going to punish her later. Well, children can children who are victims also can have that kind of communication with their perpetrating parent. So the dad is looking at the child in a certain way or saying a certain thing. There are certain triggers, and that child is reminded of that power and control and reminded of that victimization and reminded of the secrecy and helplessness. So my point, and this is a real kind of weaving around and trying to give you the background of my answer to Liz's question, is that in child custody litigation, the people who are involved in this case, if you as the advocate for the survivor know that there are child sexual abuse issues in this case, anybody else who's involved in the case needs to have an understanding of these dynamics, or there can be a real detriment, an added re-traumatization of the child, you know, and therefore of the non-offending parent, because the non-offending parent cannot protect the child unless those helpers who are brought in understand the dynamics of child sexual abuse. Okay, any questions at this point before we move on to part four on our outline?
At this time, there are no questions in the queue.
Okay. All right. So are there people on the line, right, Liz?
There are.
Okay. All right. So now we're going to go on to how come people are so misinformed about child sexual abuse. And just as you are probably really familiar with myths and facts about domestic violence, and I'm drawing these parallels so that it's really easy for you to learn, and you walk away from this going, oh yeah, you know, she talks the same language I talk. We talk about myths and facts in child sexual abuse dynamics. And the first myth that people believe is that the typical sexual abuser of the child is a stranger. And this is because all those highly publicized cases and the stuff you see on the nightly news where the perpetrator, you know, basically comes from behind a garbage can, you know, comes from behind the dumpster, attacks a child, you know, on the rural road, that sort of thing. Those are high-profile cases. But strangers, according to the statistics, strangers are sexual offenders in probably fewer than 10% of all child sexual abuse cases. Is that amazing? And it's family members who are abusers in about 47% of the cases, and then acquaintances of the child or the child's family in another 40% of the cases. So you need to understand that the vast danger to children of sexual abuse actually comes from probably inside their own homes. The next thing that you should probably understand, and this gets back to Liz's question about child custody litigation, is there's a myth that allegations of child sexual abuse are common in disputed custody cases. And that's just not true. It has not been borne out by the statistics. Again, it's a few cases that are highly publicized and people talk about, and it sort of elevates them. There was a large study that was done about a decade ago, about I guess maybe in 2000, of 9,000 custody cases. Okay, 9,000 disputed custody cases, and only 2% of them contained sexual abuse allegations. And about half of those 2% were deemed likely to be true. Okay, and this is a myth that you have to really be cognizant of, because what you'll have is, and we have this in Florida, where we'll have visitation staff call the hotline. This is a child abuse hotline, and report suspected child abuse. And the first thing that the worker says is, you know, the hotline worker says is, is this a custody case? And if the supervised visitation staff or the supervisor says yes, the hotline worker is apt to say, oh, well, it's probably not a true case. We're not going to waste our time on it. Okay. We have to be really careful to make sure that people don't get away with that, that allegations are really pursued, followed up on, and that we don't dismiss concerns simply because there's a disputed custody case. You've probably all thought of that before and dealt with that before about domestic violence. Oh, there's an allegation of domestic violence. Is this a disputed custody case? Well, then there's really no domestic violence. This is all about a struggle between the two parties, a he said, she said. You've probably heard it all before. It's not true, but it allows people to cling to myths. All right. Another myth is that children can give consent to sexual activity with adults. Okay. This is, you know, the old blame the victim, right? You've heard this before. And sometimes you hear perpetrators accusing the child of consenting to and then even initiating the sexual contact. This allegation becomes more frequent the older the child is, but we've seen cases of 5 and 6 year olds who've been blamed for their own sexual abuse by the perpetrator. So what you have to be aware of course, is the fact, and you know this, that adults have more authority and power, and they're the ones who have the capacity to impose that sexual behavior on the child. And children have, you know, even if they watch TV and they video games, they have little knowledge about the societal implications of being involved in a sex acts with adults. But, of course, adults have sophisticated knowledge of the significance of a sexual act with a child. And the reason this is important, too, is because I don't know if everybody's seen it, but just within the last 3 weeks, MSNBC came out with this big story about the fact that child pornography is on the rise. And we are seeing in Florida, because we've got the Clearinghouse on Supervised Visitation, right? We've got 65 centers in Florida. And we have seen more and more cases where dad is addicted to child porn. And we have the court system is not sure what to do with these people, because we don't have studies that show whether watching child porn means that your particular children are at risk, or whether there's any protective factors because of the anonymity of the pornography on the computer. It's still a crime. Possessing child pornography is still a crime, but child pornography has exploded. And you're going to hear about it. You taking this training, again, I'm going to congratulate you and applaud you for actually sitting through this terrible lecture. But you are going to have this heightened awareness, and within the next week or two, you're going to hear something on the news that's going to pop into your consciousness that wouldn't have without sitting through this training. And one of the things is that we are seeing a rise in people using child pornography, especially on the web. And the court system is going to have to grapple with this because, you know, think of this. If you have a victim of domestic violence who does not know that her child has actually been a victim, right? She's not sure. She doesn't think that the child has, but she knows that her husband is addicted to child porn on the Internet. I mean, it's incredibly frustrating and upsetting because judges aren't sure what to do about that. And the lawyers for the perpetrator, well, the domestic violence perpetrator, at least the batterer, are saying, well, the two have nothing in common. There's no tie between the person viewing pornography and being a threat to children. So you're going to start seeing this more and more. It's a national phenomenon, and we who try to keep our ear to the ground on the new things going on with supervised visitation are seeing this. We have one program that called me, I'm not kidding you, in the last week. We do monthly phone calls on technical assistance for our programs. One program within the last week that has three divorce cases where the dad is addicted to child porn on the Internet. Just, you know, I mean, this stuff is, and we never, you just didn't hear of this before. You just didn't hear this before, and now we're hearing it, you know, every week. Okay. The next myth is, and this is a tough one, because you've heard this before, substance abuse causes parents to sexually abuse their children. Okay. This is a myth, and it's a myth just like alcohol causes a batterer to physically abuse his intimate partner. Okay. What we do know in domestic violence is that substance abuse can make the violence, the domestic violence, more lethal, right? We do know in child sexual abuse cases that substance abuse is often used as an excuse. If I weren't stoned, high, drunk, if I didn't have this problem, Judge, and again, we're getting back to child custody litigation, then I would not abuse, okay? And that's exactly what child sexual abusers say, and is exactly what batterers say. And so if you just put me in a Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcanon, or you put me in a program and I'll get a sponsor, then you don't have to worry about me with this other type of behavior. And that's not true. Just like it's not true for domestic violence, and it can actually make the batterer meaner when he's off his alcohol or his drugs, it's not true for a child sexual abuse. Right? So sexual abusers are cunning, manipulative, and who have you heard this about? Individuals who can convincingly deny allegations. Sometimes, if there's overwhelming evidence, right? Okay, there's overwhelming evidence, then they beg mea culpa to the court and say, I'll enter into even an inpatient treatment. I only abused my kid because I was intoxicated or I was stoned. Okay, and what you need to understand is that neither alcohol or drugs or stress, there's another one, stress. We live in a stressful environment and the economy is terrible and I'm under a terrible amount of stress. Okay, none of those things causes adults to be sexually interested in children. Okay, now, some perpetrators may work up the courage to molest by taking drugs. Okay, so we have researchers who say that some perpetrators work up the courage by drinking, right, or by taking drugs. But the deviant patterns existed before the alcohol, before the drugs. And so what that leads us to, so again, you know, even though we have this broken into a very clear agenda, you can see where, you know, some of these things hit issues of litigation, some of these things hit the issue of the of myths and facts, and we're kind of bouncing around a little. But where this leads you to, this myth, leads you to something that is different, well, that's probably different in domestic violence, because what researchers believe in child sexual abuse is that sexual offenders can't be cured. Okay, so the myth is that sexual offenders can be cured. And there's a big caveat for this, but I want you to first listen because it's depressing. Okay, this is part of the depressing part. Okay, first of all, there is no machine, no test that can definitively determine that somebody is a sexual abuser, okay? And there is no there's no magic way to cure a person. I mean, you've heard of like chemical castration. Okay, well, chemical castration means that a man cannot get an erection, but a man can still rape. He can use an object, all right? And so what therapists say, and this is according to the American Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, say we don't look to cure sexual offenders. What we do is look to managing their behavior and taking them out of situations where they can abuse kids. And this is where you get those bubbles around schools and you get the the 50-yard radius of sexual offenders. They have to stay away from places where there are vulnerable people because that's a way to manage their behavior. Now, the difference, the caveat that I want to give you here, and the thing that makes you a little, probably a little more optimistic, is that while the research about adults is extremely depressing, and it's more about managing behavior, giving sexual offenders information and knowledge and helping them understand, get empathy for victims, learning about their own sexual deviance, understanding what strategies can help them maintain control of their own behavior, right? These are the kinds of things that we talk about. These are the practice standards for members of the Association for the Treatments of Sexual Abusers, right? So the goal of treatment is to teach them how to manage their behaviors to refrain from reoffending, that kind of thing. And there's actually a standard that says, and this is important for you to know, in the child custody litigation again, because the ATSA, this is the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, says that members of ATSA shall not make statements that a client is cured or no longer at any risk to reoffend. So that's really important. Okay, so instead what we talk about is managing behavior. Now the glimmer of the shadow of hope is that that's not what researchers say about juvenile sexual offenders. And we do have on the agenda a couple of words about juvenile sexual offenders. And I what I want to tell you about them right now, in contrast to adults, is that researchers do think that especially the younger you get them and the least that they've offended, the ones who've offended less and happen to be younger, they do talk about stopping and ending the offending behavior. Okay, they don't talk about that with adults, but they do say that treatment is a lot more hopeful and outcomes are much better with younger offenders. Okay, so those are important things that you need to know, and we keep kind of going back. I'm giving you little tidbits throughout about this issue of child custody litigation and disputes. Okay, so now we're back to our myths and facts. So the myth that we just talked about was sexual offenders can be cured. We don't talk about that as adults. We don't talk about a cure. We talk about managing behavior. All right. Another big myth, of course, and we talked about this right at the outset, is that all sexual child abuse is disclosed. You know, the assumption by adults who've never been victimized is, of course, it would be disclosed. I would never let this happen to me and not tell somebody. And, of course, you already know that most experts agree that statistically reports of sexual abuse are actually low compared to the actual number of suspected incidents, okay, just like in domestic violence. Let's do a few more myths and facts because we're okay on time. Here's a really big one, and this happens, let me tell you, folks, everybody who's a little bit jaded, who's been out there professionally working with difficult cases and clients, we all sort of think we've built up this expertise. We all think we've built up this sort of knowing, okay? And that leads us to believe in this myth that you can tell, that it's easy to tell. I can tell. This is you thinking to yourself. I can tell whether somebody's a sexual offender, okay? And it's a myth, folks. You can't. Child molesters can look like everybody else. And, you know, here again, the similarities to domestic violence, right? Child molesters, if they're even molesting their own kids, there's not a typical molester. There's no test or instrument. You can't look them in the eye and know whether their pupils are dilated or not dilated, whether they're offended. You, the hair on your back of your neck, your gut, your stomach, you know, may not tell you when you are in the presence of a sexual offender. And actually, one of the preeminent researchers on child sexual abuse said that the most striking characteristic of sex offenders from a diagnostic standpoint is their apparent normality. They look like everybody else. So it's really important for you not to assume that when you look at somebody, I've seen in child custody cases, the mental health professional who says, you know, I talked to this guy and he seemed absolutely normal to me and I don't think he could have offended. You know, that's a very, very dangerous myth to buy into. And I'm sure you've seen it with mental health professionals who think when they're in the presence of a batterer that this very nice, upstanding citizen who, you know, is employed and whose home shows pride of ownership and who has the, you know, the perfect cookie-cutter family could never have committed domestic violence, you know. Plays the organ in his church, does, you know, says all the right things. So, again, another similarity between the two. And another another myth, and then we'll get on because it's almost four to get to the rest of our agenda, is that some people believe that if a child is sexually abused by a family member, it's just a one-time experience. You know, it's the child waking up in the middle of the night and the parents on top of her, you know, penetrating her and raping her. You know, and that's the way that sexual abuse happens. And as you've probably now figured out from the last hour we've spent on the phone, that's not true. That there are children who have been sexually abused a single time before disclosure, but the typical pattern occurs over a period of time, can progress from normal contact to sexual activity. Okay, this is that grooming process we talked about, right? The abuser's using secrecy and power and control, also sometimes rewards. And there's this conditioning of the child to accept increased sexualized contact. And so the way this often looks, and I'm going, I have a chart, and I just want you to kind of picture it's kind of linear. It goes from observing the child, and this is observing the child bathing or undressing, and then the adult starts increasing his nudity, right? So the adult starts being nude in the presence of the child, exposing genitals to the child, massaging the child in a lingering manner. And then there's fondling, and then there can be masturbation in the presence of the child or instructing the child to masturbate. Okay, and so this goes often on this continuum to fellatio, to digital penetration, to penile penetration, and that is more typically, and of course there are going to be lots and lots and lots of exceptions to that, but that's typically what you see, especially in order to have the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome kick in. Okay,
Karen,
yes.
This is Liz. I wonder if we could break just for a minute and stop for questions and comments at this point.
Sure.
And particularly in the case of fact and myth, I think it might be interesting to see if there's any questions or comments that anyone would like to offer up at this point. So, Carrie, will you remind us again? It's star one.
Sure. At this time, if you have a question, all you need to do is actually just press the number one on your touchtone phone, and that'll get you into the question queue. And it looks like we did prompt a couple of questions here. Our first question is going to come from Victim Witness Program Pima Company. Your line is open.
Hi. Yeah, we're from Pima County in Arizona. My name is Vanessa. And a question popped up when you were talking about how sex offenders can't be cured and how the research sort of backs that. And so I started becoming just curious about, is there research out there about how one becomes a sex offender and where that sort of starts from? If there's any research that says in a particular area, or if it's from childhood, or if it's from genetics, or yeah, where that sort of comes from.
Okay, Vanessa, and that's a very good question. Unfortunately, the information that we have is grounded in interviews that have been done with people who have been put in jail, you know, as sexual offenders. So we've got the research comes from people who've been caught, people who've been put in prison. And so what we have, again, is one of those straight lines, not forward, but backwards. We have a very high percentage of people who've been caught sexually perpetrating who claim that they were victims as children. So, you know, we're not sure how high that percentage is. It is not a straight line forward. In other words, all victims of sexual abuse are not condemned to becoming sexual abusers. I do not want anybody to think that. But we do have a very large percentage of people who have gone to prison for offending, who have been caught, who say that they were perpetrated on, that they were traumatized as kids. And the number, that's the number one dynamic that you get for perpetrators who claim that they were abused as kids. Now, you often will see other types of family dysfunction. As you well know, you rarely have one type of family dysfunction in a family. You can kind of have these constellations of problems. You have where the child spent a lot of time alone. You have where the child didn't have support, family around, supportive systems around. You can have instances where the child comes from parents who abused substances, and you very oftentimes have perpetrators who also have drug and alcohol problems. But, you know, there is no cocktail for making a sexual abuser. And here's the thing about the fact that the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Offenders says, or abusers, says that there's no cure. Still, judges are now put in the position that if they, even if they catch somebody and someone is convicted and they go to jail, those prison terms, especially with incest, are generally short prison terms, you know, shockingly short, like a year, 2 years. And then they get out and they want to have contact with the child again. And so then you have the question where the lawyer for the perpetrator says, well, he did his time and now he's cured. But if your prison system is like most prison systems in the United States, the emphasis is not on any kind of psychological counseling to try to manage your own triggers and manage your own issues and dynamics. It's on putting you in jail and punishing you. And so you really have to spend some time educating the court about why the person has not been cured. It's not like robbing a bank and we put you in jail and you're going to get out and you're not going to rob banks anymore. It's just not the same thing.
Thank you, Vanessa. Carrie, is there another question on the line?
There actually is another question. Let me find out who that is from. Looks like it's from the Inner Center for Nonviolent Living, and your line is now open.
Thanks. My name is Nana, and I thank you, Karen, for your time today. I just wanted to ask you, you had mentioned that when custody cases are the issue and allegations are being made, that they're often dismissed and that we shouldn't allow in our area, the Office of Children's Services, to be able to minimize or dismiss those so quickly because they are custody cases involved. So I know that our particular agency here is extremely overworked, and I'm just wondering what suggestions you might have for us to be able to hold their feet to the fire. You know?
That's a very good question. And here's what I would do instead of viewing it as holding their feet to the fire. I would view it as collaboration, outreach, and cross-training. And the reason that we have this statute, the Keeping Children Safe Act, is so that we have broad cross-training on child sexual abuse issues. And so there is a training on the web that we have on our website that's free and available 24/7 on child sexual abuse issues that child protective workers, guardians ad litem, supervised visitation staff take. We've got hundreds of people who take it every month. So what I would do if I were you is really start leading the charge that people who deal with families in crisis and people who work with children have to have this training. Because honest to goodness, when you have this training and you are a well-intentioned person who really wants to help people, it does change the way you think. And I have done this training where I have had really good, hardworking people, volunteers or people in social services agencies who've dealt with these people over, you know, with these clients in litigation over years, who come up to me in tears after the training and go, oh my God, I look back at this case, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, and I did the exact wrong thing, and I didn't see the signs, and I wasn't really sure, and I think I committed a terrible, terrible mistake. I mean, we even have had judges who say, you know, oh my God, I've got goosebumps because I don't know if I made the right decision in a case, and now I'm going to probably have nightmares wondering whether I did the right thing. So I really do think that if we started with the assumption that people do want to do the right thing by these families and they do want to help, these kids and these non-offending parents, then they need to get this training. And that's why, you know, if you're in a small community, this information is out there on the web, and you can take this training, and it heightens your awareness. And getting that kind of, you know, getting that kind of training, it takes a few hours to take the training online. And then you can bring in, for instance, bring in a mental health professional who does have expertise in your community, who can come in and do a brown bag lunchtime training on child sexual abuse dynamics. And I hate to take, you know, to have you come to this, you know, 90-minute training and give up part of your afternoon, and then what I'm telling you to do is go back to your community and do more work. I hate that, because you guys are the ones who are always doing all the work. But unfortunately, the only way that this can work consistently in a community to protect kids is if you're not the only ones who have this information, is that everybody who works with these, from the child protective workers to the shelter staff to the guardians ad litem to the, you know, to the judges, to, you know, to all these people, to have this training, and then you're all on the same page.
And so, Karen, what is that? Do you happen to know the website, or is that a link that people could contact me for?
I'm actually sending you the link right now, Liz.
Okay.
And then you can come right. You can go right onto my website, and you can actually take the training. Now, you guys have had the bulk of the training. I also have a PowerPoint that you can give to a mental health professional, and they can, you know, because then they have a tool, and they can come in and do a brown bag lunch with them, and I'll give that to Liz too. You know, we'll give this. There are resources out there, but what I, you know, it's the minimum is for somebody to get on the website and actually kind of go through the pages and watch the little videos, and there's a film called Scared Silent that we recommend. It's like from the 80s, but Oprah created it, and it's by Ames Multimedia, and if you are one of your social services agencies, invested the $100 in it. It's a great DVD because it talks about, you know, here's this all-American family. They live in this Brady Bunch house. They got two little blonde, tow-headed girls. The father is an accountant with a little pocket protector in his pocket. The mother plays the piano. The father plays the organ at church, and he's been abusing these daughters since they were 4 years old. And you know, it's really shocking because here's this really white bread family that looks like they could live across the street from you, and this man has been abusing his two daughters for years and years and years. And that's the kind of stuff that shakes people up, because you wouldn't know, even that you've passed this guy on the street before, and you've passed this girl, you know, these girls were in your class when you were in high school. So that's called Scared Silent, and it is referenced in the online training, but it is a great thing to show for, a brown bag. And I hate to say lunchtime training because most of this stuff is stomach-turning, but I know that when you do continuing education sessions, a lot of people use, you know, a lunchtime thing, and we do that throughout, especially for our guardians.
Very good. Thank you. So, Karen, we have probably about 25 minutes left, and it seems like a bit of an ambitious outline yet to cover. So should we go back and dive in and then break one more time, let's say, in about 15 or 20 minutes for questions if we can?
Sure.
Okay, super.
Sure. So let's see. The little pieces that I skipped ahead of before on your, if you're following your agenda, is in number 4, the bullets on some of the basics of the effects of child sexual abuse. Okay, and that's important, but that stuff is pretty, what's the word I want? Intuitive, okay, because you guys have worked with these, with families, you know what the effects of domestic violence are. And so you're going to understand that there are both physical, behavioral, emotional, short-term, long-term effects. And when we talk about physical effects, the really tough thing that we need to talk about is that there are not going to be, quite frequently, maybe 25% of the cases will actually have clear physical signs of sexual abuse. Okay. More likely you're going to have, especially in cases of incest and abuse by, say, you know, step parents, you know, not rape, okay, where you would have blood and tearing and that sort of thing, but and genital injuries. But only about 25% of the cases are you're going to have clear physical signs that there was sexual abuse. And of course, just because you have those signs doesn't always mean that there's been a clear perpetrator. That's when you get into the, well, yes, there are signs of sexual abuse, but we don't know who actually committed it. The father blames the boyfriend. The boyfriend blames the neighbor, you know, that sort of thing. So you have genital injuries, sexually transmitted diseases, urinary tract problems. You have, and if you ever buy that video, you'll see the girls couldn't understand why nobody noticed that they walked funny. Why didn't anybody ask them why they didn't want to sit down? So you have difficulty walking or sitting. You have preoccupation with genitals, especially for younger children. And then toileting accidents, and these are, of course, non-age appropriate. So those are some of the physical effects. And, of course, another one is pregnancy for children, for young women who have started menstruating. So beyond the physical effects, you also have now behavioral effects. And children who have been sexually abused have different kinds of behaviors. And when I tell you what these behaviors are, you're going to say, how does that prove anything? Okay, they have nightmares. They have sleep disturbances. They have changes in behavior, withdrawal, lack of interest in activities. They have eating disorders. They act out. They're promiscuous. They have fears, irrational fears, or they participate in self-injurious behaviors. Of course, those behaviors, those behavioral effects, can be caused by other traumas in the child's life, right? I mean, some of these are really familiar to people who understand the effects of a child witnessing domestic violence. Okay, so these behavioral effects aren't really helpful, but it's good. It's important for you to know how devastating the effects of child sexual abuse can be. Then you have, of course, emotional effects of child sexual abuse. You have fear, depression, guilt, shame, numbness, dissociation, and post-traumatic stress. You've got children who are severely traumatized by their sexual victimization. And when we talk about child sexual victimization, all children are not alike. So victim characteristics can mediate the impact of the sexual abuse, especially when we're not talking about really obvious physical signs, because violence is one of those, the greater the violence, the greater the negative effect is on the child. Okay, but there is research that shows that there's a number of factors that can mediate the impact of that abuse experience. Okay, so that doesn't mean that there's some abuse that's good and there's some abuse that's bad. Okay, it just means that kids are different. And it also is important for you working with the non-offending parent, because the most important mediator is the social support that the child has, okay? The protective responses that the child experiences after disclosure. So you have this non-offending parent, and non-offending parents, when they're also victims, survivors of domestic violence, I mean, you've got a big knot to untangle. You've got non-offending parents who are experiencing every emotion that you can possibly imagine, every negative emotion that you can possibly imagine, right? Guilt and shame and fear and anxiety and horror, and really reducing their ability to function when a non-offending parent realizes that this has happened to her child. And so you look at that and you say, on the other hand, the most important thing the most important mediating effect on a child, a mediating factor for a child, is the relationship that the offender has to social supports, to the protective responses, right? So you've got, dealing with the survivor, you've got to get things in line as quickly as you can, because it is absolutely true that the non-offending parent needs to be able to help the child. And as you know, you can't help somebody else until you yourself have dealt with this huge package of negative emotions that have now just rained upon you. We also know that non-offending parents have more alcohol abuse, depression, substance abuse. Now, this can all be, of course, a reaction to the domestic violence that's going on in the home, the knowledge or the suspicion of the child's abuse. And it's not that we're blaming the non-offending parent, but it does give you, who is an advocate for the non-offending parent, a real uphill battle, because in order to be what we know is what the child needs, that is the non-offending parent who's protective and supportive, okay, that non-offending parent has work to do to get there, to be that supportive, protective factor in the child's life. So the other things that you should know about mediating factors is the closer that the child's relationship is to the offender, right? So the relationship between the victim and the offender has an impact on the effect of the sexual abuse. So we have studies that show that sexual abuse by the father or the stepfather has more short-term and long-term impact than abuse perpetrated by a stranger. But violence, that's the tearing, the blood, right, the bruising, violence is an issue that affects the impact and intensifies the negative effect. And also exposure to pornography, exposure to nudity or exposure to masturbation or forced masturbation, those kinds of things are awful, but it is vaginal and anal penetration that really does increase the negative effect of the sexual abuse, right? Because sexual abuse can run the gamut of different kinds of behaviors. But the studies do suggest that penetration does increase the negative effect of sexual abuse. And so that's important that you should know. So if sexual abuse is involves physical abuse at the same time, if there's beating and rape, then the impact on the child is going to be greater. So these are the characteristics of the abusive event. And the other thing is, and you may have seen this in domestic violence cases where you have a child who tries to protect siblings, and so the relationship of the child and the siblings can have an effect on the impact of sexual abuse on the child. So if the child is singled out, let's say the child has siblings, but it's only this child who's sexually abused, and the other siblings are not, the impact of the sexual abuse can be greater. So there are these things that mediate, but the overwhelming thing that you should walk away from this phone conference from, instead of all that other stuff that I gave you just because I wanted you to know, the overwhelming thing you need to walk away from is the quality of the social and protective support is the most important factor on how the child recovers from the abusive experience. Okay, that means you've got a big job ahead of you in dealing with the victim's non-offending parent, because you very rarely have high functioning, ready to cope with this and move on non-offending parents, right? I mean, and I'm not saying that to be humorous. This is often part of a larger constellation of problems and dysfunctions in this home, and you've got a non-offending parent who I talked to a woman. It's been a few years since I talked to her, and I should probably catch up with her. That reminds me, who told me that she had had a child who died, and it was easier a second child from a second marriage who'd been sexually abused, and it was actually easier to deal with the fact that she had a child who died, not by her own hand, the child had died in an accident, than it was dealing with the fact that this other child had been sexually abused over a long period of time, and that she was having trouble coping, but that the only reason that she could carry on was because she knew the child really needed her. And so if you remind your clients that if you go on and you get better and you cope for no other reason than because this child needs you, and this is the number one thing that's going to have an impact on this child, is how you react to it, how you come back and be strong for this child. And I hate to do that, because here we are again putting all this emphasis on what the victim has, you know, what a non-offending parent has to do, or the victim of domestic violence. And it's always her we go back to. But the research shows that the non-offending parent's protective and supportive behavior toward a child after learning about the abuse has a huge impact on that child. Okay. So what I want to get into next, before we take our break, this is really important, is reactions to disclosure. Okay, so I've told you all these really terrible things in this last hour, and what I need to tell you now is, if a child discloses to you, if a child begins to disclose to you, you have to walk a really fine line, and you have to give some thought, and you and the people in your agency and your organization, if you haven't ever done so, you need to give some thought and some role play to how you're going to react when a child discloses to you or starts to disclose to you. Because, A, you don't want to look horrified and upset and shocked, because that just shuts the child up, right? But you certainly don't want to get into asking, quizzing, pulling out further information from the child, you know, cross-examining the child. You certainly don't want to do that, because you're going to end up tainting the child sexual abuse investigation. You're going to then be accused of interfering with the investigation, that you have put words in the child's mouth, and you're going to become the problem. Don't let the focus go back to you, okay? But because this is such an awful thing, I really do highly recommend that you role play. And let me just give you a little example of role-playing, because you guys are really tough, and you've been out in the field, and you're really good people, and you've seen a lot. But we had an exercise at a training that I did for supervised visitation folks. We had a practice on dialing 911, okay, because there's actually been studies at major universities that showed that we all know about 911, we all know how to dial 911, but in a moment of panic, half the people who pick up the phone to dial 911 dial it wrong. And yet, 911 is probably the most easy example I can give you of everybody should know how to respond. And so what researchers tell us is, you know, pick up the phone when it's unplugged and practice dialing 911. Okay? So, folks, go back to your agencies and practice responding to a disclosure of child sexual abuse. Go through it once. If you've never been through it in real time, go through it just to prepare yourself to go through it. Because, and you will probably have a nightmare that night, and it's horrible, and you have to deal with it. But better to do it in a role-play situation than dealing with it for the very first time when there's a child standing before you telling you something that you certainly do not want to hear. I am going to send to Liz the statewide. There's actually a couple of websites that have state statutes on them, right? So this is the Child Welfare Information Gateway, and then there's the RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, that has the state laws and links to where you'd go for your definitions of sexual abuse, and national child abuse hotlines, and the statutes that talk about general abuse reporting, you know, all that stuff. So you need to have that. And if you don't have that up on your bulletin board, and you have a pro bono attorney who works for your program, or you know somebody, or you just go get a student who gets that information and puts it somewhere now when you don't need it, so you'll have it when you need it. And we've now talked about assisting that non-offending parent to help her child, right? The best way to get her to help her child is to understand how important her role is and get her to where she's at a place where she can offer that support and protection. Now, Liz, boy, that was good timing. Any questions now?
If you do have a question, all you need to do is press the number 1 once on your phone. Okay, we do have a couple of questions. Our first question comes from Domestic Violence and Abuse Center. Your line is now open.
Hi, Karen. This is Kathy in North Dakota calling. Is there a an outline, so to speak, on a role play that we could connect with on the internet and use in our office to practice? Do you have anything in writing?
I do not, Kathy. I'm just trying to think. I know where there's a, you know, if you went and Googled child's disclosure to sexual abuse, you'd get several things, especially on the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. But I've never seen where they actually give you the role play. And I think that maybe you just give it. Do you mean what your reaction should be? In other words, you might want to sit there and talk it through what you would do, because you're not going to have an exact replica of what's going to happen when it happens in real time.
Absolutely. I guess I was just looking for some guidelines on, you know, what not to say or what to say, or and staying away from some of those questions that may taint an investigation.
Yeah, I'll send a couple of sites. When I send this the RAIN information to Liz and the link to our website, I'll send a couple links that you guys can look at.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, our next question is going to come from Safe Shelter. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Hi, this is Mary Thysel from North Dakota as well. My question is this. What if the non-offending parent is not supportive and protective of the child?
Ask that question again. What does the...
What if the non-offending parent
okay.
is not supportive and protective?
Yeah, and so what you have is non-offending parents who can also engage in that minimizing, denying behavior. I mean, that's sort of the ugly truth about some non-offending parents. But that's mostly because they can't. It's so overwhelming. They can't imagine what to do with this information. And when you read some of the stuff on the web, we actually have this visualization activity that we do because we've done this training, honest to goodness, I've done this training over 2 days where we do, you know, role plays and we do visualizations and we do small groups. But the point is that everybody, most people will shut down to some extent when they first get this information, and that they can also engage in victim blaming and minimization and wanting the perpetrator back in the home. I mean, you have some of that. But now that you are armed with how important it is, you need to start unpeeling the onion and unpacking the suitcase for the victim. I mean, really getting the person away from the minimization and telling them about the effects and the whole concept of knowledge is power. You know, you can go back. You will be, this child will be happy again. This child can have a normal future. You can be a mother and child again. And taking it slowly and really working with that victim. Now, or the non-offending parent and the victim of domestic violence, that mom may need her own counseling. And we're talking about everything from grief therapy. I mean, because there's a ton of grief that goes along with realizing that your child has been victimized in your own home, okay? You may not have those skills. I mean, you know how to counsel someone who's been a victim of domestic violence, but you may need to bring in a different mental health professional who can help mom get to a place where she can be supportive of her child. This job may be bigger than you, and that's okay for you to realize. You can go as you need to do exactly, you know, as much as you can do, but it may be that mom's going to need long-term counseling to get to that place. If there are other supportive adults, maternal grandma, right, the aunts, if there are other supportive adults, sometimes family, friends, those are important supports for the child too. Social supports generally are very important to the child. We just always try to start with that non-offending parent, the non-offending mom. So if you are aware that there's a problem with her support, who's the adult who's going to help that child? Who is the adult in this picture who the child is going to be able to rely on for understanding and support and not shame and anger and grief? And you often have access to those people. You know, it's going to be family, friends, or it's going to be relatives. And that person may have to step up until the non-offending parent can get back on board.
Carrie, are there any other questions in the queue right now?
There actually are. Our next question is going to come from the Barbara Kettle Kunlak Shelter. Your line is now open.
Thank you. My name is Mary, and I'm working with a family. The custody has already been determined for quite a number of years, 2004. The child went to was a young a little boy went to Head Start disclose something to the grandma, and they made aware to protective services. And since then, the child is now 9, and gone through extensive talking to people about, you know, and not talking, actually. He's kind of says he's done now. He's told his therapist, he's told protective services worker, he's told his father who did this to him, allegedly, hasn't gone to the criminal court. He's told his mother, of course, his grandmother. He's told the person who's doing the children's the child visitation. He's told his therapist. And the only one he hasn't told is the friend of the court and the judge that I would think would be in this picture. And he's still being made to see his father at least once a week. They tried to take him to a physician when he was 4. The child just absolutely refused. So there is no evidence, physical evidence, medical evidence, other than that all the behaviors that you've been talking about for the last hour and a half. And I know we're ending here, and I have a very large question with what I want is a miracle answer. And I don't know where to go from here. I mean, who else does this child have to tell? He's 9. He says he's done. He's told everybody he does not want to see his father. He's said what he's did to him. There's so much more that he has to talk about with his therapist. And every time they get to the therapist, it's talking about visitation. I've been at my job for 19 years here at the shelter, and I've never, ever heard of a victim having not only of sexual assault but of domestic violence even, sitting in, other than in testifying in court, but in a counselor's office telling him specifically what he's done to her. And that's what this child has been made to do. And I guess I'm at wit's ends, and I don't know where else to pursue this without botching the case, so to speak, you know. I mean, if he needs to be held criminally, he needs to be held, but where do we go to do that? I mean, we're trying to work for the little boy, not anyone else at this point. But.
Well, that's a very case-specific question.
I wish I would have asked in the very beginning, but I was following your outline.
Yeah, no. And it seems like it's one of those intractable cases. But one of the things is that the guardian or the court-appointed special advocate does need to understand about child sexual abuse so that the guardian doesn't dismiss it, right? So we need everybody to be on board to believe the child. I mean, this is a case where we'd be talking about this for an hour because the question is, does the guardian not believe the child because he hasn't talked to the guardian yet?
Well, there is no attorney that's been appointed. There's an attorney for the family, the mother of the little boy who's been my client since the domestic violence and their divorce.
And is there no guardian ad litem or a court-appointed special advocate who can be appointed for this child?
No, there isn't. This has never gone before the courts as a sexual assault case. It's always been a visitation case.
Well, let me tell you a couple things, and then, because I won't be able to solve this for you. But one of the things that I will tell you, I don't know whether it'll help, but the older children get, the more power they have vis-a-vis a parent they don't want to visit. Okay, and so in Florida, we rarely see teenagers in visitation because they just won't get out of the car.
He's been pulled out of the car.
Oh, that's outrageous. I mean, no child should be physically forced to visit with a parent.
When he says openly he wants to kill his father.
Oh, my God. I mean, what about a mental health professional who says that it's not in the child's best interest? I mean, visitation is overwhelmingly an issue of the child's best interest.
Right. Exactly. We've gone through it over and over and over and over again.
And then you have a mental health professional who tells the court that it's not in the child's best interest to see this parent? And don't you have in your state, you know, what age will judges start talking to kids? Because it's generally, you know, generally judges themselves have their own lines. They won't talk with a child under age 8. They won't talk to, you know, what about the judge bringing the child into chambers?
Right, that's what I said. He's 9. I mean, the friend of the court has never even talked, you know, she's never even talked to him.
I guess I thought you meant by friend of the court. These two people, first of all, if mom's represented by counsel, counsel needs to consider asking for an in-camera review of the testimony that's been given to all these people, to have a private meeting with the child. I mean, this is all going to be governed by your state laws and what your judge does about talking to kids, but it happens. Judges talk to kids.
Right. That's what I'm trying to pursue. And
yeah, well, but I would go first to the friend of the court. I'm not really familiar with how that works in your area, if it's like a GAL, but generally that's why you have a friend of the court, so that the judge doesn't have to take the child into chambers, because there's that whole stress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we don't want to subject this child to any more stress. And so the question would be, why isn't the friend of the court talking to the child?
Right, that's what I want to know, too. And I just wanted to know how, you know, I know we're not in the same state, but how to pursue that without getting people, you know, to the point where they say it's already been dealt with. You know, I suppose more motions would have to be filed or something, but...
Yeah, I mean, this is a nightmare of a case, but there's still two very important steps that have not yet been taken, and it seems that the missing link here is that mental health professional who stands up for the child and says, if the child's in counseling every week, the mental health professional should have some type of a recommendation to the court. Then the court then rules on, and whether the mother likes it or not, can appeal the ultimate decision to the next. I mean, there needs to be, the process needs to actually play itself out here. It sounds like you're sort of at the standstill.
Karen,
oh, right.
And Mary,
right.
This is Liz. I'm sorry. I think we're going to have to end our call. I'm really sorry, Mary. I know that this is something that it sounds like your program is really struggling with, but I think we're going to have to end the session today. Karen, do you think that RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, would have any helpful resources for Mary?
Yeah, I think that everybody who's on here needs to identify people in your communities who do have training in this and be able to consult them about these kinds of cases. I mean, this is why knowledge is power. And there are people in most communities. I mean, unless you're the most rural, and you've got somebody somewhere in your state where you can call and they know, because that's the thing. You got to know the state law too. And, you know, you've got to know state law, state procedure. So somebody locally, make it your job to identify someone and then consult them about these really prickly cases.
Right. I want to just thank you, Karen, very much. You are a wealth of information, and thank you for your dedication to the issue and the time that you've spent with us today. It's clear you have a lot of years of experience, and we have benefited from it quite a lot. So thank you very much, Karen. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. Again, thanks to all of you. Karen, take good care, and I'll look forward to speaking with you again.
Thanks, Liz. Thanks, everybody.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You, everyone.